You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even the speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Hey y'all, got another Art History Babes reboot for ya? This episode was originally released August 4th, 2016, and we decided to get it back out to ya this week in honor of Artemisia Gentileschi's birthday. She was born in Rome July 8th, 1593. So happy birthday, Artemisia!
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Ginny.
I'm Jen.
And we are the Art History Babes.
Today we're going to be talking about Artemisia Gentileschi.
Oh, that hot babe.
But before we do, Ginny, you went to SF MoMA recently. How was that?
I did. It was an experience. It was so crowded. It was crazy. But it was good. It was kind of an odd start to my time in the museum because I went into one of the bathrooms on the main floor and it was painted bright ass red. Like every single surface was painted this like candy apple red. And it kind of hurt my brain a little bit. Color theory was a while ago, but I was like, oh, this jars me. This doesn't make me feel calm.
Yeah, yeah. It's like an aggressive, in your face color.
Yeah. And like, I don't know. I don't know if I want that when I'm in the bathroom.
I think Nat has a selfie of her in that bathroom.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really like mysterious and looking.
She took a cool, mysterious selfie.
Yeah,
I did see
people taking selfies in there at the sinks.
I will definitely take a selfie in that bathroom.
Me too. I think we should do like a group selfie.
Yeah.
In the bathroom.
No, we'll each do our own and we'll do like tiles.
Compare.
It'll be great. We'll do, yeah.
Oh man, that's going to be lit on Instagram.
So lit. But it was really cool. It's 7 floors, so it's a lot. I certainly didn't do all of that in one day. I mean, even in being like an art lover, museum fatigue, it's real. It's out there.
Oh,
and we need to talk about it.
Yeah.
But I still got to see like a decent amount of the museum, and it's very like crisp and clean. It's all this like blonde kind of white wood stairwells and white walls, so it has that kind of like clean look to it. But speaking of
it.
Like as we're recording this, it's Duchamp's birthday. And I saw so many urinals mounted in the MoMA.
Do you mean fountains?
Yes. Works of art. I found like there were a couple by this artist named Robert Gober. Maybe it's pronounced the French way Gobert. I don't know.
I hope it's Gobert. Sounds cool.
But those were for him. He just had 2 white urinals mounted to the wall. And then I found this just gem of a urinal that is the exact, it looks exactly like Duchamp's fountain, but it's like gold, which is really kind of cool. And that is by an artist named Sherry Levine. And so that was cool. So that's just like a little connection with Duchamp.
Aww.
But overall, it was a great time. There's a lot to see there. A lot of Andy Warhol. I was telling these girls before we started recording, there's one of Andy Warhol of just his face, and it's like camo print. And I walked up to it, and I just laughed. I was like, Andy, you look fucking goofy.
Yeah.
But it was a good time. It was cool.
Awesome.
We should also give Nat a shout out.
Yeah, Nat's not with us today. We miss you, Natalie.
We miss you, baby. Hope you're having fun living it up.
you know?
I think she's in Malibu right now, maybe? Probably.
Jeez.
Jeez, Nat. But anyways, okay, so Artemisia Gentileschi, little bit of a trigger warning. We will be talking about some rape and some violence in this episode, as it is kind of central to her biography, or conceptions of her biography anyways. So heads up, if that is a problem for you, you might want to skip this episode. But we won't be talking about anything in any sort of like graphic detail, but it will just be regularly discussed. But yeah, so without further ado, Artemisia.
Okay, so just to give a little bit of backdrop on Artemisia Gentileschi, she was born in 1593 in Italy, and she was the daughter of another painter named Orazio Gentileschi. And a lot of painters, female painters that are known today from like the Renaissance and the Baroque, this is often the case where they're born into a family where a father typically is a trained artist and then they are kind of then trained themselves. But she is significant for many reasons, which we will get into. But most particularly, she is the only female follower of Caravaggio, who, if you remember Caravaggio, he was one of our stars in the Bad Boys of the Baroque episode.
He was quite the bad boy.
So she was a follower of Caravaggio and painted in his style, but really made quite the name for herself as a female painter during the 17th century in Italy, which was certainly not an easy thing to do, nevertheless be successful at it. So
she had the good fortune to be also active in Rome, which was a very advantageous place to be. As we have discussed, Caravaggio worked his way to Rome in order to further his career. And so that was a little piece of good luck for Artemisia.
For sure. And, you know, she is by no means the only specifically like Italian female artist from the Renaissance and the Baroque period. She's just the one that we're going to cover today. But just to give some little shout outs to some of the other lady artists from around that period, Sofonisba Anguissola, Lavinia Fontana, Barbara Longhi, Elisabetta Serrani, Onorota Rodiani, who actually had a promising career, and then she murdered a companion that tried to rape her. So her career kind of sidelined a little bit.
Damn.
But autocorrect, her first name is not Properties, but but my name, my phone changed it. It's Propezia, but De Rossi. So those are some other ladies that deserve some shout-outs and that we could very well get into in future episodes. But Artemisia, this one's for you, girl.
Yeah, and you know what's great about Artemisia is that we are so fortunate in our modern-day art historian world, and we know so much about Artemisia because of the extensive written record surrounding her life.
Mm-hmm.
Big part of that written record is the high-profile rape that Artemisia Gentileschi experienced in her lifetime, and it becomes one of the central themes that shapes a lot of her work. Side note, that's not really true. That's what the art historians so far have said about her work, and that's how...
Well, it is true. The rape is true.
But... No, the rape is true, but what I mean is that the idea that her work was shaped by her rape is a story that has been perpetuated throughout the years and has been the popular story among historians who write about Artemisia. And so that's what we're going to talk about today, is really how it doesn't do her justice. And I don't think that it's fair to sort of think of her work through this lens as like a survivor, but we're gonna deconstruct that
because,
a little bit.
Like most women, she is so much more than her relationships with men.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the way that most accounts of Artemisia's life have gone in what we've seen so far is that her life and her career are sort of wrought with this idea of her sexuality being like central to her life. And historians really identify her as a rape survivor.
Right.
And so, therefore, even feminist approaches to Artemisia's life center their discussion of her life around being a rape survivor. And so it's a lot of this idea that she developed a feminist consciousness after her rape, and that that expresses itself in her paintings. Some of her most famous works are biblical scenes, and two big ones that we're going to talk about today are Judith beheading Holofernes and Susanna and the Elders.
Mm-hmm.
So these are two big works of Artemisia that we think of her and these works when you associate them. And she was very fond of these subjects and would paint them several times.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing that's interesting with Artemisia, too, is that I read one particular, it's very short, we'll post on the website. The title is great. It's called My Heart Belongs to Daddy, The Fictionalization of Baroque Artist Artemisia Gentileschi and Contemporary Film and Novels.
Oh my God.
And this, you know, just kind of goes into the fact that, you know, Artemisia Gentileschi wasn't really that popular, like, in the art world, in the art historical world, particularly, like, kind of popular culture until, like, the 90s. And this was when books began, you know, people were writing books about Artemisia, and they were kind of like historical fiction. And she does have a very interesting biography, that's for sure. But this kind of leads to this somewhat like fictionalization of her, or rather a way of looking at Artemisia Gentileschi that is very much from like a 20th, 21st century perspective. And the author of this article makes a really good point where they say, you know, these thematic constructs used by current writers to refashion a 17th century woman into a contemporary celebrity, which I think is really interesting and a good way of kind of summing up some of what we're going to talk about and really trying to understand Artemisia Gentileschi and study and talk about her in a way that is fair to her as she was as an artist and a woman during the 17th century. So that's kind of what we're going to get into.
Yeah. So on that whole sort of looking at Artemisia's life and her experience through a 20th and 21st century lens, I think it's important to point something out, which is that the way we think of Artemisia's rape is very much shaped through this modern lens, where generally speaking, in like 21st century society, we think of rape as this action that it harms the body and it harms your reputation, but it crucially it attacks the self, and it does so by violating private boundaries that we have about our bodies. And so when you violate these private boundaries, you are therefore violating the self and the conception of the self. And that is a very damaging thing for just, you know, your most basic ego and well-being. And so that is very much a 20th century lens to rape that we have today. And 20th, 21st century. It's still weird saying that. Gosh.
I know. I still write 2015.
Yeah.
All the time.
So. Well, and so it's important to remember that in the 17th century, which is when Artemisia was alive, many people saw their physical bodies as somehow lesser than the spirit. So very much like this Christian sort of worldview that dominates, especially in Rome.
Oh, like the capital of the Christian. The capital world. Yeah.
So for people in 17th century Rome, their personal identity would be composed of several elements. Many of those are external and they weighed much more heavily than the internal. So, that being said, the effects of a rape could very much ruin someone's reputation and really limit how much a woman in the 17th century could really move around in society.
Yeah.
And it would very much damage your success, especially as a woman artist.
Right. Yeah, it was like taking away your value because, you know, at the time, like being a virginal bride was pretty vital, you know, like that was like your trade. Like it was all kind of, you know, this property based like value that, you know, if you were chaste and if you were pure, then like you would be a good bride and then you would be, you know, married and be a part of your husband's family and get taken care of in that way. So if that gets removed, then that in a sense can remove your value, depending. Of course, there were loopholes.
Right. But you know, you could have a very difficult life after a rape in the world of the external image that really dominated this 17th century Roman social scene, however you want to think of it. So without getting into too much detail, Artemisia was raped by an associate of her father's who forced himself upon her. And then after, due to her obvious rage and indignation of having been violated, promised to marry her. Mm-hmm. And that is where the whole thing becomes a very well-documented written account of all of the events after this is available to us. And that is because the man who raped her and then promised to marry her then just kind of backed out, right? So it was like, oh, you know.
Well, he was already married.
Yeah, he was already married and his wife was like missing or something. Yeah. She like left him probably because he's a terrible raper. Yeah. Okay. He's a terrible guy.
Horrible human being.
And he rapes and he needs to, you know, not have a wife because it's terrible. And anyway, so he doesn't marry her and therefore he is taken to court and there is a very lengthy trial, and a lot of the trial consisted of Orazio trying to make sure that this marriage would take place. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the reason is because a lot of his reputation is on the line as well. So
Which is so fucked up when you think about that. That like, okay, oh cool, her dad's like, you know, gonna take him to trial and it's gonna be this whole thing. But the end game was that for them to actually get married.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is just crazy to think about. Because
it's, it's the whole thing about she's her father's property.
Right.
Until she's another man's property. So her father has something to lose in terms of, you know, her being a commodity and like, right. It's just all so messed up.
Well, and so here is where like we get to the gist of what really was at the heart of Artemisia's struggle during this entire ordeal was that Artemisia was ultimately concerned with restoring her good name and reputation. Because she wanted to be a successful artist and she wanted to be able to support herself and be successful. And so therefore, it's not that she shouldn't be recognized as having strength for being a survivor of a brutal violation of her body, but also she should be thought of as a strong woman because she not only overcame sexual assault, but she managed to reclaim her dignity and restore her good name and restore a reputation where she actually had a pretty successful life. And for a woman in the 17th century, she did very well for herself. And so I think that what's a good takeaway here is to think of strong women as resourceful women. And I really think that that best characterizes Artemisia and the way that she handled this situation is that she ultimately wanted to restore her reputation.
Yes.
And so the problem is that so far, most of the written account of Artemisia's life really looks at her career as a sort of like art therapy.
Yeah.
For having experienced a traumatic event. And that is where we have a problem.
Yeah. Because while, you know, Artemisia has been long dead, so none of us can know for sure all of her motives for the paintings that she made. But I do think it's important to view Artemisia Gentileschi as a professional painter, and that because that was her profession, she was a businesswoman and she was very savvy in doing what she did. And I think, you know, it's pretty evident that she was very conscious of what she did with her paintings and applying them to the patrons that she was working for at the mm-hmm. time, the cities she was working in, and, you know, kind of the audiences that she was trying to target with her works. And I think that that is, in my opinion, a less biased and kind of more like scholarly approach to looking at Artemisia Gentileschi's work and her career as an artist.
And it also is a way to look at her as someone outside of her sexuality. Because that's right. A big problem is that this idea that she is just intertwined with her sexuality. The sexuality really comes to define her identity in speaking of her as somebody who was creative and made art because of having experienced this traumatic event.
Right. Which just doesn't seem fair, really. You know, she was born into a family where her father was an artist and she was around that life and trained in that life before she was even raped. Of course, you know, something like that could have an effect on the work that she made, but just looking at her through that lens is too reductive.
Yeah, and with that in mind, we want to talk about a couple of her works. So one of her most famous works was painted in 1610, and it's called Susanna and the Elders. And in this story, Susanna is, so this is a biblical scene, and Susanna is bathing in a garden, and the elders are these two men, and they're essentially peeping Toms, and they're watching her bathe. She's nude, and they are being very gross, and they are violating her personal space, and it's very disgusting. It's
dirty old men.
Oh, absolutely disgusting. Anyway, so in this story, they're peeping on her, and then they proposition her. And she refuses their proposition. So, being then very upset, they go on to try and soil her reputation. And they spread rumors that, you know, she had sex with them. And she's married in this story. And so she's...
I think so.
She's married or she's betrothed or something.
She's married, I'm pretty sure.
She's taken.
Because of this, they decide to put her to death for adultery, and she is found not guilty right before she is killed. And so it's very like, oh my gosh, just a terrible story. And in this story, many art historians have wanted to attribute her choice of subject matter to this sort of like cathartic action of painting a scene where a woman's word is not worth anything, and she has to fight to restore her dignity, and so it's very easy to think of this subject matter as being influenced by what she's experienced in her real life. But that's very reductive, and I think that the modern day conception is that more of these scenes were, I think, Gentileschi. Is it Gentileschi or Gentileschi? How do you pronounce that?
Gentileschi. You got it. Yeah.
Okay. So we can think of this choice in subject matter not only as a scene of a woman who does ultimately come out on top, but also these paintings end up becoming popular because she does them so good that she starts to, I believe, paint subject matter that she's gonna get paid for.
Yeah.
So
business
they're
savvy.
Yeah, and the painting's really interesting. She's shown as having an understanding of real female anatomy. The breasts have gravity, and that's wonderful. I like to see that as opposed to the bolted on look by some of our favorite Renaissance artists. And it also demonstrates this understanding of a female position in male society.
For sure.
And so there's a lot going on here. And We should also discuss Judith and Holofernes.
How about we do that right after we take a break?
We're going to take a break.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even the speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA Playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA Playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
They're here to slay the art history, babe.
Right. What are we getting into? Judith slaying Holofernes? Holofernes?
I'm sorry. It's not that funny, but it's kind of funny. Judith slaying Holofernes, also known as Judith beheading Holofernes.
Because that's how she did it.
Yeah. So she slayed by beheading. So we're still on the subject of Artemisia's work being understood as this sort of art therapy. And we're not down with that. So we're continuing on that route. So Judith beheading Holofernes, this work was completed between 1614 and 1620.
Mm-hmm.
And it is depicting the story from the Book of Judith in the Old Testament, which recounts the assassination of an Assyrian general, his name was Holofernes, by an Israelite who is Judith. And the painting is depicting the moment when Judith, having snuck into the enemy camp and having got Holofernes very, very drunk with wine, nevertheless.
Naturally.
Yes, yes. And so he gets very, very drunk and he falls asleep. And Judith is accompanied by her maid servant, Aubra.
Mm.
And she grabs a sword and props herself up on the bed of the general and starts to hack away at his neck.
The way that you...
That was perfect.
It kind of sounds like she had like a axe or something, like
so,
hacking away.
And God, you know, I'm sorry, I just saw Fatal Attraction the other night for the first time. I had never watched
Classic.
It. And I was just blown away. Glenn Close, you are a hot babe. Anyway, I'm sorry, back to this. So in the story, you know, Judith is attempting to seduce Holofernes, and she gets him very drunk, and the whole point is that she's going to kill him. And Artemisia did not tone down the violence or anything for
the
that
gore,
matter
yeah,
in
no.
this painting, and so that's why my very graphic account makes a lot of sense if you're looking at this painting. But it's such a great work. So we are going to compare it to the painting by Caravaggio of the same of the same theme, which was a very popular theme, actually.
Totally.
And in Caravaggio's depiction, Judith is shown kind of like disgusted. Like she's kind of like, ugh. And
it's so hard.
It's yeah, like she looks kind of just like, ew. Oh God, you really do get that vibe that she's very much like grossed out by it. And what's funny is that that's kind of the version that most of us know. It's the most popular one by Caravaggio, and Aubra, the maidservant, is this like very old, like crony, But in Artemisia's version, both Aubra and Judith are young and strong. They have thick,
forearms, and they look like, we're here to get this shit done.
Yeah.
We got work to do.
Yeah, Abra is shown from above, and she's just on top of him, and he's trying just really...
He's got her hand, his hand, like her throat, like she's unfazed.
And his hand is huge, too. It's like the size of her head.
Yeah.
And Judith is shown on the side, and she's got her knee propped up on the bed, and it's very much like you really get the sense of the force that it's taking to cut this dude's head off. So it's a very different treatment of the same subject matter, and I think that that's really important to think about, because the way that this painting has been thought of, once again, is Judith is kind of representing this, like, rage that Artemisia supposedly fosters towards maybe males after having endured this experience of the rape and ensuing, basically, like, humiliation of a very public trial.
Yeah.
So it's easy to read the painting in that light. But I think that what we're seeing here is a very, like, visceral moment of a woman who really just needed to complete a task, which was kill this guy.
Yeah.
She shows, like, no emotion. Like, she is very unfazed. She's just, like, doing her work. Yeah. She's just like, I had to kill this dude, and that's what she came here to do.
Yeah. She's got her sleeves rolled up, and she's taking care of business. And it's a great painting. It's and you really get the sense of the effort that it takes to do this. And she's composed. She's focused.
The effort it takes to, like, murder
saw off a head.
You know, I don't think it's easy. I don't know.
I've never tried it,
but I bet that it's hard. So, you know, we're really going on and on about this, but I'm just, you know, there's so many little details, and you guys really need to see it for yourselves.
Yeah. And I think, too, you know, it's a painting that I really think exemplifies Artemisia's skill, and I think that we can certainly view it as work that she was proud of and that she meant to display her talents, and the fact that it was made, like, by her. Which is actually going to lead into, I read this really interesting article all about specifically Artemisia's signatures on her paintings. And the article is called Identity Signs, Meanings and Methods in Artemisia Gentileschi's Signatures. And it's written by a Judith. Uh-huh. Coincidence? I don't know. Judith W. Mann.
Oh, that's even more interesting.
I know.
What a badass name.
Judith, I appreciate this article a lot. But so basically, what this article talks about is the particular placements of Artemisia's signatures on her paintings. And out of some odd 48 paintings that are attributed to Artemisia Gentileschi, she signed 19 of them. So this means that about 40% of her works were consciously, like, autographed by Artemisia Gentileschi. And she really, you know, we can kind of view this as a way of her making her own declaration of, like, creation by herself. So talking about the Judith and Holofernes painting, her signature on that, it's a little hard to see, but it's on the sheet that's draping from the bed close to the blood dribble or the blood spray.
It's a spray. There's a lot of blood, but then look at the beautiful folds of the fabric.
And the elegant script. Like I said, you know, she's showing what she can do. And this was pretty common for the time for artists, regardless of gender. You wanted to, you know, you were selling your talent. You were illustrating what you could accomplish. Or maybe it's somewhere on there.
I'm looking very closely. Like, where is it?
But what's interesting about what she wrote on this painting, she wrote Ego Artemisia Lomi, F-E-C. And Lomi was actually the surname of her father, which is a last name that is Tuscan in origin, and her father was from Tuscany. When he moved to Rome, he changed it to Gentileschi, which is a Roman last name. And so she would switch her signatures from Artemisia Gentileschi, Rome, to Artemisia Gentileschi, connecting herself more with Florence, depending on which last name she used. So on this one, she says Lomi, and this is the painting that is in the Uffizi to this day. So clearly this seems to be a conscious tool that she used to connect herself to the city she was working in, to the patrons that she was making this work of art for. And how she kind of further portrayed her own artistic agency is that, you know, in the way that an artist writes something like, this was made by Ginny van Dyne. Obviously, I haven't made anything, but...
That's not true. You have that really nice painting of that dog.
Oh, yeah.
That you did.
That's true.
That's a lovely painting.
That's my dog, Pearl. Love you, Pearl. but typically, artists would sign using the simple past tense or the imperfect. And the imperfect would suggest that a work could still be ongoing. So if you used the imperfect tense, and this was even suggested by Pliny in his Natural History, so it was like very much grounded in a lot of art practice at the time, that if you used an imperfect, it would kind of suggest this sense of humbleness, like, oh, you know, this was made by me, but I could still make changes and it could still be better and it could still use improvement. And many, many artists use this imperfect tense. However, there were artists that would use a simple past tense, and in Latin it would be F-E-C-I-T. And this would suggest that it was complete. So it's a sense of confidence, like, this is done, this is perfect, it was made by my hand. Mm-hmm. An example of an artist that did that continually was the Venetian artist Titian. And what is really badass about Judith and Holofernes, what tense does Artemisia use? Simple past. She's like, I'm done, bitch. This is it.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
That's what you're
it's
getting.
Done.
Like, you know.
Be aware, it was made by me, and it's done. So this kind of, to me, shows that she was really aware of her role in a male-dominated world and a male-dominated career, for that matter. And that, you know, she just used these signatures as not only a way of kind of ensuring, like, the authenticity, but promoting her own career and showing that, like, hey, this was made by me. And by using that simple past tense, that was kind of showing her own confidence in her work.
Yeah.
Which is, like, really cool.
She knew she was good.
Yeah.
And that is so amazing because as grad students, like, we'll write, like, a paper and we're just like, this is the biggest piece of shit I've ever written in my life. I don't even want to put my name on it. And you're just so ashamed. And then, you know, but it ends up being, like, not bad. And you know what I mean? And so I would love to have an ounce of Artemisia confidence.
Right? That's a really good point. That is so relevant. Oh my God. Yeah. But no, I mean, she, like, these signatures are so fascinating, and the author of this article points out that it's really, like, overlooked by a lot of art historians and, you know, feminist historians in the work of Artemisia, you know, because obviously a signature on the painting, that's just, like, a tiny, tiny little part of the painting. But if you study it in terms of the language that she used, the placement, you know, I think it really can lead a lot to understanding her as being, like, a businesswoman that knew how to kind of promote her own skill set and be able to work in different cities using, okay, I'm in Florence, so I'm going to use my father's original last name of Lomi. Okay, now I'm back in Rome, I'm going to switch back to Gentileschi. And so this just kind of shows her, like, savviness and ability to adapt to different patrons, different cities, locations, cultures.
Yeah, it really just says a lot about how someone portrays themselves to just, like, advertise anything. Like, when you think about, like, even just, like, this podcast, like, the different ways we try to kind of portray ourselves on different social media platforms, like, you have to be, like, smart about it. And this, I feel like, is just kind of, like, the 17th century equivalent.
Seriously.
Of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, out of all of the paintings that she made signatures on, only one of them did she sign the back. Every other one that she signed, it was, like, a prominent placement. And another painting that's a good one to look at for her signature is the Conversion of Magdalene, or it's called the Penitent Magdalene. And this was at the time when she was working in Florence. And this signature is actually, like, dope. Magdalene is sitting on a chair. And on the side of the chair, in gold paint, she signs off with her name. And this is, again, showing off her skills, but it's also kind of connecting her back to her kind of Florentine roots, where her family previously, like the Lomi family, were known for gold work. And so she's consciously using like these different signs and symbols to kind of say like, okay, you should pay attention to me because of this. And I have this connection to Florence and my family has, you know, like a deep rooted, I'm going to use the word connection again because I can't think of a better word.
Association.
Yeah.
That's a good
one. Yeah. For sure. So this was just a way of her indicating her Tuscan heritage as well as her artistic skill. And, you know, she carried this through in a lot of her different works. And even in the work Gile and Sisera, this is a really interesting painting. And it shows, you know, Sisera is about to kill Gile. And in the background, there's like a stone kind of pilaster. And her name, her signature is in the stone. So this is, you know, the way of her kind of marking her permanence, where it's like her name is literally written in stone. And it depicts, again, like a female figure that's like very strong, not afraid of violence. You know, she's wielding a weapon, and like framed by that is Artemisia's signature. So this was all incredibly conscious as Artemisia was signing these different works that she did and just kind of tapping into all of these different ways which she could appeal to different patrons in different parts of Italy. And she even painted for the king in England. So she did it there too. And
damn,
you know, she was just like a badass businesswoman. Like, she knew how to move her work and herself and appeal to different patrons and like get her name out there, which, you know, I have a lot of respect for.
Yeah. You know, and she ended up having a pretty successful life. She ended up living comfortably. She ended up being an artist who was able to support herself through her painting, which is amazing, in 2016.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And she did
it. She was, like, practically a single mom, too. She remarried, but he was, like, a deadbeat.
Yeah, he was kind of just, like, a lazy piece of shit. And, God, the plight of the strong woman. Oh, man. But Artemisia, God, she just did it all. And I think that it would be really fun to leave off on her self-portrait.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. I love this painting. She is wearing this amazing dress.
Yeah.
And
I want it.
We talked about this dress, actually, in a class that we took mm-hmm. just this last quarter. We went very in-depth on this specific kind of silk that this dress is made out of that is so fine that it reflects all these different colors. It's like this varying, like multifaceted silk that looks different from different angles and different lights. And bottom line being that it is expensive. So she paints herself, painting herself, maybe? Who knows?
Yeah.
And what's great about this painting is that we don't see the canvas. We don't see what she's painting. The entire work is framed around literally just her in the action of painting. And so you see her holding a paintbrush. She could be looking around her canvas to her subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
And she looks super determined and super focused. And in this work, she's showing herself wearing some of her best garments, which you would not wear this dress if you were 18. Okay.
Confidence.
But, yeah, confidence. She's like, I'm not going to get paint on me. But she also just has this kind of like messy hair look.
Mm-hmm.
Like she just kind of threw her hair up in a bun and was like, I'm going to get this shit done. And,
yeah.
And we can all identify with that.
Yeah. Every day of grad school.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, the top knot, like every day. And this is the allegory of painting is the name of it. What year was this painted?
Oh,
let's find out.
Yeah, we're gonna find out. Oh my goodness, where the hell is it?
And it's a really like fascinating painting just in terms of symbolism.
Oh, 1638 to 1639. It's the title is Self-Portrait as the Allegory of Painting. So not only is it a self-portrait, but she is painting incarnate, which is
the coolest.
That's
thing.
So cool.
She was so dope.
God. And it's a beautiful work. And I feel like in this painting, she did an amazing job once again at really depicting this like composed, focused, just, you know, in the zone kind of woman. And, gosh, you know, I just really appreciate that.
We all love her so much. Harness the confidence and the power of Artemisia as much as possible.
Yes. Yeah. And always question if you're ever learning about an artist, which is a wonderful thing to do, whether they are painters or musicians or what be it, really be conscious of the association that you're making between their biography and their work.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's really a big issue in the life of Artemisia, and probably we can think of a number of artists who have had crazy lives, and I think that it's something that we do. We want to find meaning in art, and we will look wherever we can, and if there's detailed biography, we're going to extract meaning from there, and that's fine, but you always should question and be sure that you're not being one-dimensional when you're considering the work of an artist such as our girl, Artemisia.
Yeah. And on that note, we would love to hear what you have to say about Artemisia, about her work or her biography or the connections you've possibly made or kind of what you think about our thoughts and interpretations. Feel free to email us at arthistorybabes@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, all that jazz. Do we know what we're going to be doing next time? We don't yet.
You know, it's kind of up in the air right now, I think.
We have a lot of ideas.
So many. And I think what would be really fun would be, we might keep it on this woman artist role that we're kind of on right now. But if any of our dear listeners have any ideas or, you know, want to ask us any questions, we will take any and all input. So, please feel free to
We'll try and cover all the mediums, too. We're going to do an architecture one at some point because I'm the in-house architecture nerd. So that'll happen. That'll happen.
I really want to do one on brutalism architecture. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, shit. And like defensive architecture, like in cities where they put spikes on sidewalks so homeless people don't sleep in.
Oh, man, there's so many directions.
We have so many ideas.
And we still need to go back to the comic book thing because I'm getting into that now. I've been like doing some research on that vein.
Welcome.
So like, stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Got some interesting things coming your way. Thanks so much for listening. We love you so much.
We love you.
Arrivederci.
Art History Babes out. The Art History.